This week's podcast is sponsored by BOTB.com. You might know Best of the Best as the dream car competition company who have been giving away cars since 1999. Well, now, as well as having a weekly dream car winner, they will have a weekly lifestyle competition, giving you the chance to win top-end motorbikes, £10,000 in cash, luxury watches, and high-spec gadgets. Some of the cool prizes up for grabs include a 77-inch LG OLED TV, a DJI drone bundle, a £3,500 Sonos system, and a £4,500 Apple bundle, amongst many others. Get online and give it a go at BOTB.com. Tickets start from just 15 pence, and you could be the next weekly winner. Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 16th of July. And joining me on this edition, Ed Sally.
Oh, your helmet is so big.
Kaz Harlow.
If you can read this, you don't need glasses.
And Mark Buttrick.
Even in the future, nothing works.
It's not coming home. They're coming home, unfortunately. It all ended really quite quickly and it didn't look like it was going to end as quickly as it did. The second half of the semi-final just seemed to... You know,
they came back out and they wanted it more.
Water through the hands, or sand through the hands. It just seemed to run away from England, unfortunately. They did look a bit tired as well, I've got to say.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, no one can be too unhappy with how this particular World Cup has gone.
No, they did a lot better than anybody had put them down for.
The only problem is this now sets up the next 20-year cycle of over-expectation and crushing disappointment. Because let's face it, we're now people will now be having some wildly optimistic thoughts about Euro 2020. And with that, ignoring the fact that all four sides in the semi-finals were European.
Yeah,
and the vast majority of the sides in the last eight were European. So,
got to remember as well that some of the favourites fell by the wayside early on as well, which is not going to happen next time around.
Well, we'll see. There will be different favourites that will fall by the wayside. That's always the way of things. But I don't believe for a second that the Germans are going to do nothing for 2 years after the performance that they've done there. And the Italians are already busy. Correcting some of their more pernicious mistakes, and who knows, by 2020 the Dutch national team might have realised that Ronald Koeman shouldn't be anywhere near management and they might be quite good as well. So yeah, lots to be done. I'm very, very pleased with how it's gone. I think it's been a fairly positive experience, but my worry is that we now have reset from, if you like, the 1990 point of the last semi-final, and we'll have the next ensuing period of wildly over-optimistic belief in what we're capable of. But, that's me being depressive.
Kaz, I read somebody saying that they would rather have gone out in penalties than seemingly just running out of steam in the second half. Would you agree with that?
I think it felt like we were really dominating to begin with. So it was difficult watching them get almost rope-a-doped so that they were, tired towards the end. And, they were up against an opponent who'd kind of saved their time, bided their time, and had the energy to go that extra mile. The trouble with penalty shootouts is, for me, it's like we've just watched you play for 2 hours. Let's flip a coin and see who should win. And I always find that's tough for teams who've played really hard. So I almost wish we had penalty shootouts, because I love the goalie. He seems to be just a ninja. But by the same time, it's not, for me, it's not a reflection of a team's playing skills. It's literally, let's fire a ball and see who hits. It's best of five flipping coins, or best of 10 flipping coins. And I don't know whether after 2 hours of watching people go at it, it's satisfying in anything more than Formula One satisfying when they all crash at the beginning. That's no reflection of the skill of the drivers. So it would have been good and exciting and better than a kind of a fizzle out, but maybe not reflective of how good our team has been in this cup.
I always think that actually there was a throwaway joke in a Budweiser advert about 10 years ago that I think should be adopted, which is super bonus multi-ball. So that at the end of extra time, an extra 39 footballs are fired onto the pitch from various sort of cannons in the corners, and the first player to put any one of those balls in either goal wins. Because it would just be, I mean, as you say, as Kaz points out, it's chance. So why not actually make it a spectacle? And, you know, that in 4K HLG, the sheer panic and fury of people wondering which of these balls they're going to hoof in what direction are perfect. Couldn't ask for more.
Okay.
So, yeah, there we go. That's so, my take.
Apart from football, what have you been up to this week, Ed?
I have been doing some work for you and other people. It's been very exciting. It's quite novel. Obviously, I'm talking to someone who lives on their own anyway, but I haven't been doing that for a very long time. So the idea of just sitting down and doing work uninterrupted is really still quite novel and exciting.
Yeah, it soon gets to you, though.
Well, I then went to a UK distributor. I had to listen to a system yesterday, a pair of speakers with 15-inch bass drivers, and the cabinet extends for a considerable size in either direction on either side of those 15-inch drivers, so they wouldn't have fitted in my old house, let alone these ones. So I thought, you know what, I'll go and listen to them on site. And I had a lovely day. That was very pleasant. And later on, I'm off down to Hampshire, and then from there, if the weather is perky tomorrow, I think we're going to go to the seaside.
Sounds like a plan. What are you up to, Kaz, apart from watching lots of movies?
Well, it's all the end of term stuff at school. So there's been loads of like fairs and school productions and things like that. So that's completely wrapped me up. But yeah, I did have a quite interesting trip to London yesterday for the first time in a while. But we can get into that later.
You picked quite the day to go to London.
Yeah, yeah, it was. It wasn't necessarily my choice, but it was well worth it in the end.
Good. Good. So what have you been up to, Phil?
You know, I haven't been up to a hell of a lot. I've been doing a lot of car shows recently, which has been good fun. There was a new one, which was actually local to me. Normally what I find is I have to drive for an hour or two to whichever car show it is. It's either north or south of the county or even down into Yorkshire. But for once, it was close to me, so everybody came and met me for a change, and we all drove up to an equestrian centre, which I thought was quite novel for a bunch of Mustangs to go to. So it was a new car show up there at a place called Iversley Equestrian Centre. And what a turnout. Excellent turnout of cars, and it was a real mix as well. A lot of stuff that I lusted after as a boy. Lots of cars there, like Lotus Esprits and that kind of thing that I'd grown up with and wanted, as well as stuff that I'd owned in the past as well. And it was nice to see them again, like a Cavalier GSI and a Astra GTE and that kind of thing. So, you know, there was lots of throwbacks to my childhood there, which, you know, I appreciated that. It was nice having a look over stuff that you were never ever going to own, Ed, but obviously stuff that like me, you'd lust after.
Yeah.
Like Mark II Escorts.
No, well, don't talk to me. Mark, I'd have one of those in a heartbeat.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Right now I'd be trying to keep it in my landlady's garden, which would probably confuse and upset her. But the dedication required to keep a Cavalier GSI in roadworthy.
Oh, and it was immaculate condition. Absolutely immaculate condition. I mean, a lot of these boys, I mean, one of the guys in the Mustang group, he also has an RS 1600i Escort, A-Reg, and it's pristine. You've never seen anything as clean, but it lives in the garage. And he doesn't bring it out if it's raining. It only goes out to car shows if it's going to be a nice day. This thing is immaculate. And they're going for silly money now as well. I mean, something like that, you're looking at the best part of 50K for something as clean, as pristine as that. And that's the thing. People are getting to our age now, Ed, where in the past they lusted after these things and never had the money or could get it insured or whatever. But they have the disposable now. So they're going out and they're buying the cars that they always wanted through their childhoods and so on, or always lusted after, and then really looking after them. And some of the stuff that was there was just phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And just knowing what people have in the garages, hidden away in the garages. If you're into cars, it was a, you know, get yourself a look at some car shows, because it's like a trip down memory lane at the minute for me.
There was a throwaway line years ago by Richard Porter, the Sniff Petrol bloke who did a lot of the Top Gear production stuff, that they were doing, it wasn't a Top Gear thing, but something else involving Jeremy Clarkson. And they had to, it was centered around Ferrari. And they were in, Maranello, it's like, oh, we could, you know, get, we need some Ferraris to fill in, you know, backing shots and stuff like that. And it actually was a week's worth of work to accrue the cars that they were sort of looking for and would had assumed would be, you know, readily available. But when the time came to do the same series in the UK, and essentially it took sort of 20 minutes for people to pretty much anything you could possibly imagine to be available in someone's garage and good to go. This country is just full of car hoarding lunatics. It's quite lovely in its own way.
And everything is appreciated at the minute in price.
We've just had this discussion about houses. Yeah. Fixed assets in a world where our currency is turning to buttons. Yeah, that's an unfortunate side effect.
Yeah.
So if anyone does want to give me a house in Milton Keynes, that'd be very kind.
Finally, I think we can go to Mark and find out what Mark's been up to this week. Maybe some pottery news, I don't know.
It was my last ever pottery, I'm afraid.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I had to try and get everything done.
You have no intention of doing more pottery?
No, it just means that I'm going to leave it till the spring. I'll do it again. But this autumn, I'm going to be hat making, so I can give you all of my millinery tips.
Well, I would be keen to know some tips on working with tinfoil, because that appears to be the hat material of choice for both the public and indeed some of our leaders at the moment. So, yeah, any feedback you can give me on that would be well received.
Mark, seeing as you're back, tell us what we can win in the competitions, please.
Right, okie dokie. You can win a Samsung 55-inch Q6 QLED TV, courtesy of Hughes, and that one closes on the 30th of July. And we've also got a copy of Tomb Raider on Blu-ray, and you've got until the 21st of July for that one. All competitions open to eligible AV Forums members resident in the UK.
And any previous competition winners?
None.
Okay, that's it for our intro. Quite a long intro, but there you go. We'll be back in a sec with hardware news. Okay, so hardware news. The World Cup is nearly over. Wimbledon is probably will be finished by the time this podcast goes out. It is the final weekend this weekend, isn't it? So both of those have been part of the BBC's 4K HLG tests. I know that lots of us have watched the World Cup. Ed, did you get to watch one?
I didn't, but I do have some interesting feedback about 4K that you might find illuminating.
Okay, well, let's start with that then.
Right. As we've gone on at length, I don't want to repeat. I've got a 4G router at the moment, so I'm on a finite. I have a finite data allowance, which I have to ration to make sure that I can do my work before I start hoving through data. Now, as part of the terms and agreements on that, I get to use Netflix without affecting that data. However, there's a tiny asterisk to that, which I hadn't appreciated, but I'm glad I've checked. That does not include 4K Netflix with Dolby Vision, or without Dolby Vision. Now, I didn't know this. Now, if you recall, a couple of podcasts ago, I was a bit concerned because, and I actually blamed my son, that a huge amount of my data had disappeared overnight. If you're interested in what sort of consumption rates you're looking at, I don't know how this will compare to the BBC because I can't do a like-for-like comparison, but a 26-minute episode of Glow on Netflix with Dolby Vision burnt 5.5 gigs.
Okay.
So, yeah, the reason I haven't gone anywhere near the football coverage in that is because I'd be on my uppers, data speaking, if I did that. So, unfortunately, I've had to leave it be. I'm hoping that by the time we have another major tournament of some description next year, I don't want it to be Wimbledon, but it needs must when the devil drives, I'll be able to give you more feedback on that.
Right, so getting back to World Cup and Wimbledon, I'm hoping that Mark, our resident sports expert, has been watching these things on his B7 and NHLG in 4K.
Yes, I have. And I think as you... the question you posed in the running order, it has slightly spoiled me now. I watched the semi on ITV and all of a sudden I kind of thought, what's with that weird jagged ball scything its way across the screen? You know, it is genuinely worrying how quickly you become acclimatized to a much better quality feed.
Where's the nearest pub to you, Mark?
Well, I can just walk up to it.
Right.
In fact, I, I watched one of the what was it, the quarter final, I think it was, or it might have been the last 16 match, nearby pub, and it's lovely because it's downhill on the way home.
Okay, but I mean, I live opposite a pub, so there's a pub the other side of the road from me, and I'm going to bring it on to the time delay. So obviously they're watching in SD, God, in the pub, and I'm watching on UHD.
I know.
On BBC, and the time delay must be close to 60 seconds.
Because I know exactly they're
cheering and all the rest, and you think, oh, the score. So then you're watching and right enough, 60 seconds later. So that was a bit annoying. As actually, when it came to the England games, I just watched the HD feed, which was only a second or two behind the SD feed. But it was getting so annoying that I was hearing everything coming from the pub, and I was so far behind. And then, of course, if you got any issues, which we did have in the first few weeks, where things would buffer for a little while and then come back, and then you'd find that you're 2 or 3 minutes behind. So that got a bit annoying.
Oh, yeah. Particularly with the way, you know, a lot of people like to watch kind of TV as a almost like a social event now, where, you know, they'll be checking Twitter, or that, you know, they'll be conversing with people on forums and stuff like this. And there's nothing quite kind of breaks the excitement at just to suddenly see everyone go, oh, you know, oh, no, you know, and then you go, what? It's nil-nil, you know. So, yeah, it does kind of slightly take away from that sense of live sports. It's all happening and everyone's seeing exactly the same thing at exactly the same moment, but it really is a small price to pay for just, I mean, it's just a huge jump up in quality. It really is.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you said this, and I have to agree with you, said this a couple of weeks ago, that you were watching it to start with and thinking, what the hell's the big deal with this? Doesn't look any better than HD, really, and all that, until you go back to the HD feed, or until you have them side by side. The jump up in quality is noticeable. But at first, I could see a few people like yourself being like, well, what's the big fuss here?
Yeah, I think it's also, I mean, it's just, you know, I went on about kind of the whites and everything, and I haven't checked out Wimbledon actually yet, which I assume would look fantastic.
It looks stunning.
The still amount, tennis, of white on display. Yeah, it is still tennis, but it's just, then all of a sudden you go back to a, you know, normal feed, and everything looks kind of darker and muddier, and it just
or it's blown out completely.
Yeah, exactly, and particularly with, you know, we mentioned before about, you know, in stadiums where you've got half in light, half in shade, and that kind of thing, and it just it completely allows you to see all of the action on the pitch. It really is, has been huge revelation to me. And I'm really, really hoping that this isn't one of like those kind of experiments which then goes dormant for a little while and then kind of doesn't come back for, you know, kind of a year or something.
Hopefully it'll stay around. I mean, who knows? I mean, it could be that, I'm hoping that Match of the Day follows suit.
That would be great.
Because that would be good if they could do that and do it. And then you're not talking about time delays or anything like that. You can watch it whenever you want to watch it. Yeah, so Kaz, you've also got an LG B7. Have you partaken in the World Cup in HLG?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, have you watched it in HLG?
Well, I've watched it in HD off TV.
You've got to go into the iPlayer and then select it in UHD through the iPlayer. So I take
I missed all of that, so I shall definitely give that a shot. I was completely unaware. I was like, how come you guys have got the same TV?
You don't watch the podcast. You don't listen to the podcast when you're not in it, because that's kind of an admission.
I do read the comments, though.
Waiting for someone to hand out some world class abuse.
Yeah. Well, we got a little bit of feedback over the comments about Russian assassinations, but
yes.
But I think I do read the comments. I don't always get the chance to listen to the podcast I've missed.
You see, if you
and
had
I
listened,
thought you, yeah, I would have known. But I thought you guys just all had some special Sky package or something. I was like, I just watched sports on normal TV. I didn't even know this was going on. It's probably why England lost.
Well you see, you've got
one match left.
No, he's got two matches.
Two matches left. Yeah.
And one proper one.
So when it starts on the TV, Kaz, what you do is go into iPlayer, and when you go into the iPlayer app, it'll ask you if it'll tell you about it, and then it's usually the first box on the left is the game, and it'll ask you if you want to watch it in UHD. Click yes, and you can watch it in UHD with HLG HDR.
That sounds absolutely awesome.
I'll tell you what,
I'm hoping and watch the England match, and in that one they'll win.
That's one thing I haven't tested is any of the repeat stuff in HLG, or is it just HD on iPlayer? Mac, have you had a look?
No, I think it's, you can, yeah, it live, it always says, you know, do you want to watch it live in 4K in HLG, or you can watch it from the start in HD. So I'm assuming everything is HD when you watch it back.
Right, yeah, I don't have a TV next to me or I would have checked that. But anyway, moving on to Wimbledon, I have watched a little bit of Wimbledon. I don't like tennis, but it was in 4K. Now, the big difference here is that the BBC are the host broadcaster. So with the World Cup, they were taking image feeds from a third party who were there to cover everything, and then they just send it out to the various broadcasters who then, you know, repurpose it and broadcast it. Whereas Wimbledon, the BBC are the host broadcaster for that. So they have complete control over the image quality, over the compression, over everything that comes out of there, because there was a few issues with HLG stuff, a couple of games where there was a lot of flashing and that kind of thing, and it kept dropping resolution and so on. I've got to say, it looked absolutely sumptuous in UHD with HLG. Of course, like you said, Mark, there's lots of whites, and the amount of detail that was available within the whites, you know.
What colour is Subaka's skin in HLG?
Actually, I didn't see a lot of the studio stuff, because when I switched on, it was just the match stuff. But I've got to say, it looks stunningly good. There was no issues with straight lines and so on, which sometimes you get, especially if they've added sharpening or so on to the images and that kind of thing. None of that in there. The compression was excellent. And I think they've learned a lot from the World Cup, because when I first started watching the games, there was loads of compression issues. I mean, like I said in a couple of podcasts back, the grass was like dancing every second or so. It was dancing around because the pixelation and the compression and so on. And that disappeared as the tournament went on. So they were obviously learning. They were learning about compression ratios and what they could get away with and how to keep it looking good without using too much data and so on. And Wimbledon just looked stunning, absolutely stunning. So if you get the chance, and it's, like I say, it's still going on this weekend, watch some in HLG, because it does look astonishingly good. For those listeners, hard luck, it's finished. It's over and done. But at least Mark and Kaz, and not Ed, although he's got the means, but he's not got the data, unfortunately.
Save it up for the last day of the month. If there's ever a sporting tournament that runs till, you know, like the 30th.
I don't intend this to be my situation forever. So yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm interested on the feedback. As you point out, I have the hardware. It will be something I will be participating in due course. It's worth pointing. It's just as a secondary thing. I mean, I've said ages ago that it was, you know, I had no idea what my monthly data requirements would be. As it transpires, it's absolutely fine. But it just points to the fact that going forward, if this is how a lot of stuff is going to be available to us, any form of capped broadband is just going to be suicidal financially for you. So yeah, just make sure that there are no limits.
Yeah, I think that's kind of pretty much a given from here on out. Yeah, I once stayed with my father, and he didn't have any decent TV channels, couldn't pick up anything kind of on Freeview because it was down in Devon and you're next to like a granite hillside and that kind of thing. I thought, I'll just download a load of stuff. And this was in the days when True Detective came out. And so I thought, I'll download that. And then I realized, download it all, obviously, in the best quality. And then I realized that he had a 10 gig limit for the entire month on his... And I realized that I was like at about 9 gig and something, and it was like about the 10th of the month, and I was trying desperately to try and eke my way out towards the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's perfectly possible to do a normal day's, you know, internet activity, if you like.
But there's nothing like the threat of being charged for it for you to suddenly
open up
a window to see... How many kilobytes is that?
Yeah.
So, I've always gone with unlimited packages. Always. I've never gone with a cap, because I just know that I'd be living my life like that, and I'd rather just pay the extra. I know that's not an option for you at the minute, Ed, but for normal broadcast, I'd rather just pay the extra.
When, at the earliest possible interval, I will be reverting to a more conventional broadband contract. But I've been generally quite happy with how this has gone. So, you know, yeah, there is
that. But it is interesting. It does make you read the small print about what times, you know, data isn't actually counted towards it. All of a sudden you go, oh, after 12 o'clock and, oh, this app doesn't count towards it.
You know? you start living your life by the small print, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so let's move to Ed, because Ed's going to do a review. Monitor Audio Studio 50 speakers.
Yes. These are funny-looking little sods. When we did the news story for the Monitor series being launched, there's a lot of feedback going, that looks awful. A lot of other people were quite taken with it. I'm going to stick my neck out. I quite like the way that these little speakers look, but that's not what's notable about them. They cost £160. Now, we get a bit confused about pricing because we tend to just forget that inflation happens and it happens in our lifetimes. So people going, oh, I can remember a time when, you know, £150 speakers, you had all sorts of different choices. And that's undoubtedly true. But if you take 1998, 20 years ago, £150 then is £254 now. So a £160 speaker in 2018 is what would have been well under £100 20 years ago. The performance that these little speakers offer for £160 is unreasonably brilliant. They are genuinely, genuinely delightful to listen to. They are simplicity itself to place. And the first time I plugged them in, I lost an hour just tinkering about and enjoying listening to the sound that came out of them. So if you are really strapped for cash, these are absolutely fantastic. After, you know, 2 weeks of Withers living the lottery winner life, I thought we'd bring it back down to reality. And I have to say, these are unreasonably brilliant little speakers for the money. And I have to be honest, in the fullness of time, if it's possible for me to do a multi-channel review with four of those matching center and a subwoofer of some description, I have every suspicion that they're going to be very, 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 very good for that as well. So, yeah, genuinely impressive way to start the month.
I'm looking at these, Ed. Are they a perfect cube or are they longer on the...
They're very slightly deeper. They have a square front and they're 6 centimeters deeper than they are, but they're still only 20 centimetres tall, so only 26 centimetres deep. They are small speakers.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm looking at this, and our advice for a 5.1 system or above is always that the front three channels should be the same speaker.
I've asked if they can sell them individually, and they're looking at it.
Good, because that was my next question, because it looks perfect in terms of the size and the footprint, that you could put this in a rack underneath the TV, or you could wall mount it above your TV if you're in a living room, or if you're using a projector system, three of these underneath the screen. That would give you a really nice, in terms of keeping everything the same, would give you a really nice front three array there. And then if you're using the same for the surrounds, you're keeping it tonally matched all the way through the system.
Exactly. I have to say, the other thing that's quite interesting is the orange mid-bass driver is, whereas Monitor Audio traditionally is quite a fan of metal, this is a plastic infused with metallic particles. Don't ask me how that works because I have no idea. In some ways, this is a more forgiving little speaker than its bigger brothers. You can partner it with stuff which might be come across as a bit edgy with some other Monitor Audio products, and these will just keep on swinging. So there's some things there in terms of partnering them with a more cost-effective AV receiver, which I tend to find there's no middle ground with some of the more affordable AV receivers. They're either a bit on the warm and dull side, or they are shriekingly bright.
Yeah, and if they're shriekingly bright with some Monitor Audios, it's going to be painful.
Yeah, so my gut feeling is that these are well judged for that sort of role. So if we can revisit this in due course, be under no illusions, we will. And I was genuinely impressed.
Now,
so
in terms of looks, you know, when it comes to speakers, you know, most of the time I'm in a blacked out room, so it doesn't really matter about the design of the speaker. It's more for me, it's about how it sounds. But these, they do look odd if you're going to have them in a normal room.
No question at all that they look odd. But I was having this conversation with another industry gentleman yesterday whilst I was doing my off-site listening. We have reached a point in 2018 where there is no such thing as a discrete conventional loudspeaker anymore, because you are in competition with things that are, to all intents and purposes, invisible, if that's what takes your fancy. That being the case, I'd rather it was something that was visually interesting and was a talking point than was still attempting to be subtle in a world where there's, you know, that's just not the right option anymore. So I'm very supportive of how they of how they look, and I, you know, if you don't like it, that's fine. There are some other options, but I'd rather have something where there was some visual interest to it than there being than trying to make it invisible when it can't be.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm assuming that this cabinet doesn't have any negativity towards the actual sound quality, because, you know, it's an unusual design to use.
My gut feeling, and you can read more about this in the review, is I think it has a slight positive, in so much as the tweeter and mid-bass are so close together, their time alignment is really spot on. There are times when you genuinely perceive yourself to be listening to a single full range driver. And that's something that's much easier to do if you know your way around crossovers, and then the two drivers are very, very close together, which they are in this. It's one, obviously, it's something that Kef in particular has made their calling card by obviously placing the tweeter on axis with the mid-bass driver. This isn't as clever as that, but the sheer lack of distance between them makes for a very, very time aligned performance. So conversely, I know exactly what you're thinking. The limitation is that these are never going to be bass monster loudspeakers, but their cohesion across the mid-range and upper frequencies is really impressive.
And they're ported.
They are, but yeah. You do get a foam bung to slam in the back if you need to wall mount them.
Is that
and
to they the front or the rear? Sorry.
To the rear, and they have a threaded... They also have a thread mount to mount on the... I think it's the Omni Mount wall mounting system, if the fancy takes you as well.
Okay, good stuff. So that review should be up by the time you're listening to this podcast, or certainly in the week that you're listening to the podcast, that review will be up there. Going to have a look at these. They look like a bargain. Did you give it a badge? Did you give it an award?
They've got a badge, yeah. I believe they may even be a Best Buy, but I'll have to check that.
Okay, it was so long ago that you reviewed them, was it?
Lots happened in my life. It's I'm you know, constantly doing things like this. So yeah.
So you actually gave them a highly recommended badge, but there you go.
Did I think? Well, there you go. They're bloody marvelous. So just work on that principle.
And £160 a pair. They've got to be worth a try if you're looking for a nice budget speaker. £160.
Can I just ask, what kind of size are they?
They are 20 centimeters tall, 20 centimeters wide, and 26 centimeters deep. Now, don't ask me why I can remember that, but not what badge I gave them, because I don't want to know why that's the case. But that's the answer to your question there. They are those are the specific measurements.
I'm just giving you the link, Mark, if you want to have a quick look. Have you got something to add?
No. It was purely a case of, you know, I might be in the market for something. You know, I've got rid of all my speakers and then went over to become a soundbar man, and then kind of slowly the kind of pang starts again. And you think, I'm not buying floor standers. No, I'm not going to go down that route again. And, I'm kind of looking for something small, fairly discreet.
Look no further. I mean, obviously, they also come with grills. If the orangeness is offensive to you, if you're thinking, oh my God, it's Donald Trump in speaker form, you can cover up the grill. So cover up the driver. So that's another
possibility. Shame we can't cover up Trump, though, isn't it? So that's the Monitor Audio Studio 50s. Like I say, we can read the review on the forums. We'll be back in a second. Movie news. And this week, reviews. Two of them.
Ooh.
Okay, movie news and reviews. Let's start with some reviews. So Kaz said he was in London. Were you out protesting, Kaz? Or did that get in the way?
No, it was probably kind of the opposite. The film I went to see got a standing ovation at the end. So I think that's pretty much the opposite of a protest.
But what was security like getting into London then? It must have been an interesting day for you.
It was. I mean, I kind of got past it all and was oblivious to it until after I found out afterwards. And then I wondered why everybody was wandering around with, machine pistols.
You just played so much Grand Theft Auto, you felt that was how
serious. Yeah, standard. I just thought that a dozen cops wandering around with machine guns was par for the course.
But well, that's good. So, put us out of our misery. What did you go off and do, Kaz, other than look at people with guns?
Well, looked at people with more guns because I watched Mission Impossible Fallout.
Ooh.
So I got to go to the Cineworld IMAX, 600-odd people, and it was spectacular.
So this was a press screening because it's not out until the 25th, isn't it?
It isn't, and reviews were embargoed until late last night. And it was a real coup to get to go out and see it so early. I don't think I've had that. I think we got Ghost Protocol quite early, but never as early as this. I mean, it's a week and a half ahead of the midnight showing that I originally had booked. And it was well worth it.
So will you still be going to the midnight booking that you booked? Is it a good film?
It's an excellent film. I'm not going to go to a midnight showing of a film that I've seen on a preview because I'd get done at 3 a.m. and it would ruin me the next day. I was only going to go and see it because I wanted to see it as early as possible. Now I've seen it, I'm going to shift that to a sensible, normal time like every other person in the world. It was an amazing film. It was really good. It was better than all the expectations I had, and I had high expectations. If you loved the last film, Rogue Nation, which was by the same director, this is another Christopher McQuarrie film, and it builds upon the foundation of Rogue Nation and just goes full tilt, not just on bouncing from set piece to set piece. It actually has a really good story. And it does everything, at least for me, that things like the recent Bond films have failed to do. So the last Bond film, Spectre, tried to tie up all of Craig's Bonds in this neat little bundle and explain everything that had happened across, you know, Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. And it didn't work, or it didn't work for me. And I thought that was massively disappointing. And Mission Impossible, unlikely as it seems, has tied things together in a way that things like the Marvel franchise or the Fast and Furious franchise have oddly been able to do. And I never expected it from this. So it's brought in past characters, past storylines, and it's tied it up in a big thread, which is really good. It's a great throwback to the old series, which I loved, and all of the characters are there, having run with them for several movies now. They all get their time in the limelight, and I think that it is Cruise's baby, though. And I don't know, how old is he? He's like 56 now?
I was about to ask that.
I think he's
running away from his age.
Yeah, I mean, but he's tremendous. It's crazy what he gets up to in it. He does everything, and you know it's him. Which I read comments like his character's more superhero than than superheroes in a Marvel movie, but it's actually him doing this stuff. And some of the stuff you see him do, it doesn't matter whether you think as a character, you know, they'll never kill him. So, you know, there's no tension there. You see Tom Cruise up there falling off stuff, you know, falling off like helicopters, and you do grip your seat for a second there. It's a proper roller coaster ride. I thoroughly recommend it. I mean, it's better than any of the recent Bonds. And it's one of my favorite summer blockbusters of all time. It's really a franchise that's just got better and better. And I can't think of another actor, whatever, you know, his
personal
or religious beliefs or whatever, you know, extract that from it. 110%. He's gone He goes nuts when it comes to movies, yeah. And it's right up there on the screen to see.
It's one of these things that is, like you say, it's just... he's the only one I know of that does his own stunts. And we're not just talking about like falling off a table or something like that. Actually strapping himself to aeroplanes, strapping himself to helicopters, everything in camera, hardly any CGI. The stunts are done the old-fashioned way, optically if they can be done that way, or like I say, in the camera, actually happening. And CGI is used very sparingly in these films, which I always think is a big thing. I mean, apart from that Audi TT, though, when it was spinning around in the original movie, that was a bit fake.
And second film.
And I'm getting lost now. There's been five of them. But there have been really good films. Like you say, he's 56-year-old Kaz. He was born on the 3rd of July, 1962. And he's 1.7 metres small.
So are you saying that when he did Born on the 4th of July, it's actually a lie, but only by one day?
Yes.
How bizarre.
According to IMDb, anyway, he was born 3rd of July, so there you go. But yeah, because he's one of these actors that, you know, he tries to put everything in his movies, even if they're crap movies like The Mummy. I mean, that was terrible. But he's giving it his all. He's getting involved with it, and you know, he gives 110% every time he's on screen, like him or loathe him.
I'm prepared to forgive him almost anything for his cameo in Tropic Thunder. simply one of the most ridiculous and brilliant things. Yeah. I mean, of course, I'm not going to lie. I am worried about the existence of Top Gun 2.
So it's Top Gun Maverick is the name of it.
That leaves me concerned.
I'm really hoping in Top Gun 2 they have a rematch of the beach volleyball with Val Kilmer now.
Isn't he now painfully fit?
Is he?
Yeah. Well, he's got medical problems. He had cancer, so I think there's reasons why he's not in the greatest condition at the moment. But yeah. But I mean, you know, Top Gun 2, people think it's a bit of a dodgy idea to go down that road, but he's at that stage in his career and he's done so many stunts now that he's probably the only actor who can get insured for doing this kind of stuff. I really wouldn't be surprised if he learned how to fly a fighter plane. I really wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I know he can fly, but I mean, flying a fighter plane is a bit different, you know,
hang on a second. That's complicated because unless they're going to do it around aircraft that the US Navy doesn't use anymore. You can't. It's one thing to be able to fly a fighter jet. It's then something else again to be allowed near one which is actually still in service. I mean, there were a couple of Ewan McGregor was doing that piece on for the BBC on the RAF, and his brother, who is a retired fighter pilot, was allowed to come back. And I think he was allowed to fly a Eurofighter. And it was a quick 2,000 pages of procedure to be able to do that from someone who was absolutely allowed, you know, had been only comparatively recently allowed to do it as a job. So, even if he put the effort in, I don't think he's going to be allowed to go near an actual rated combat aircraft.
But this is Tom Cruise, so you never know.
you don't ever know. And imagine, flip that around and imagine the press. You know, if the Air Force or the Navy actually got that kind of publicity from a Top Gun sequel, they might find a way of, you know, kitting out an old decommissioned fighter pilot so it looks like a newer model and sticking him up there. And, you know, it'll be Tom Cruise in a fighter plane and there couldn't be any better publicity for them. So they might go, you know what, it's worth the puns.
The Navy will be on board. I mean, the Navy was very on board with the original one and put in a lot of assistance. So we'll see how we go. But I suspect it in many ways it comes back to that joke in Hot Shots, you know, where he wrote off the aircraft, you know, it wrote off a $30 million plane. Lucky I had insurance. So $26 a week, I'll be done in a million years. So yeah, we'll see how we go. But I don't know.
He learned how to fly a helicopter for this one. He spent a year and they stuck him in a helicopter by himself. They got 12 cameras attached to the helicopter. And he said that the hardest part, the most dangerous part of filming was that there were another 11 helicopters in the air. at the same time as him, you know, filming him.
Yeah.
And that was the hardest part. But I mean, he did 200 hours of flying in a helicopter in a year. That's like the amount of time that people spend in 5 years, 10 years. You know, he got 200 hours of flight time.
I can't fault the man's commitment. We'll see how it goes. My gut feeling is it's not possible, but as you say, it is a lunatic involved, so we'll see how it ends up.
Anyway, I think what's more important than this latest Mission Impossible movie and Tom Cruise is the latest Rock movie, which is out this weekend. I went to see it last night, as did our reviewer Sharuna, and I think we basically came to the same conclusion. Over time, I have grown to like The Rock and some of his movies. I like the fact that he takes the mickey out of himself, that a lot of the time, a lot of his acting is tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, he can act, which is unusual for somebody with his background, but he's built up a really good following. He's built up a mixed portfolio of work, but most of it is okay. It's like popcorn. You know what you're going to get with a Rock film. It's popcorn. It's going to be fun. Not a lot of it's going to make sense. Some of the stunts are truly ridiculous, as is the premise for this film. But because the premise for this film is so ridiculous, I mean, you're talking about I think it's 3,500 foot tall building for a start, which is in Hong Kong, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's obviously set in the near future because a lot of the tech is a bit out there as well. If you think about it, it's setting itself up like that. It's using old tropes like Die Hard and Tower Inferno, like Steve said last week, and there's some other bits and pieces in there that they're borrowing from. It's obviously playing to the Asian market as well. There's no getting away from the fact that there was obviously a lot of funding to make this film from that area of the world. But I've got to say, It's not Oscar quality. It never will be with The Rock in it. It's not as bad as some of the stuff that he has done in the past. I'd say it's kind of on a par with where he has been recently, which is it's not as good as Jumanji, because Jumanji was just brilliant. His performance in that was superb. He just set himself up completely in that one. But if you're thinking about the action stuff he's done, he did Rampage recently, which I enjoyed, which was popcorn fare, which was completely unbelievable. But you know that going in, you're just going in to be entertained and for a few laughs and to see some over-the-top stuff. And that's exactly what you get with Skyscraper. It's so over-the-top. It's so unbelievable. It's so ridiculous. It's entertaining. It's thoroughly entertaining. And I didn't look at my watch once. It was good pacing. And again, it was extremely predictable. You knew where it was going. But because it was predictable, the little bits and pieces that didn't quite go the way you thought they were going to go were surprising and entertaining. And if you've got a fear of heights and you see this in IMAX, there were some scenes there where I was feeling really uncomfortable, just because of, you know, the height and the view of the camera that was using and so on. It was like my worst nightmare. And there's some of the stunts in this that are utterly ridiculous. And we were saying Tom Cruise did all this stuff and genuinely leaping from building to building and all the rest and breaking a leg in the process of doing that and so on. There's no way The Rock did any of this. There's no way The Rock, with his frame, one leg, and his weight, taken off from the angle that he takes off in the trailer, and I'm not giving away any spoilers here, would make it to the other side.
That in the actual first promo post?
Yes.
Didn't someone point out that his actual arc, he wasn't going to make it? You know, it was almost saying that The Rock dies in this film.
More or less. And again, you're coming on to the thing that Kaz picked up on with Tom Cruise. There was a vulnerability there. There's a case of, you know, he could cop it and a lot of the stuff, because he's doing it for real and all the rest, it has you on the edge of the seat. Whereas this is just popcorn fun. You know where it's going. You know it's predictable. You know there's no real peril. There's no real danger here. But The Rock's just, he's good at this kind of thing. And if you're looking for a no-brain, entertaining film, I've got to say I was disappointed that it wasn't a little bit more adult than it is, because it's a 12A. And, you know, some of the bad guys, they were a bit sort of 12A, PG-13 levels. I think it would have been a better film if it was a nastier film, if that makes sense. But because it's family friendly, because it is The Rock, it's a little bit downplayed in that respect. But overall, I'd probably give it a 6.5 to 7. And
what's the stunt, man? What's the stunt double look like? Is it at least going back to the absurdity of, like, you know, someone who's at least you know, kind of looking nothing like the lead actor. Just, and he can't even wear a wig with The Rock.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I didn't notice. I know where you're coming from. But yeah, it's around the sort of level. I mean, Sharuna said in her review that it's not as bad as San Andreas. I'd say it's probably about the same level as San Andreas, touching on Rampage, that sort of level of entertainment and ridiculousness. But it doesn't take itself seriously at any point. So you kind of forgive it for that. And the plot points and all the rest of it, it moves along at such a rate that you're not really thinking about, you know, massive plot holes and all the rest of it, and how the hang did he do this, and hang on, that doesn't make sense, and so on. It's entertaining popcorn fun. So if you're at a loose end and you're still waiting on Mission Impossible opening because it's not going to open for another week and a bit, it's worth going along and spending the hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes. It's entertaining.
Good. I think every The Rock film should just have the tagline, if you like The Rock, watch it. You know, if you don't like him, you're not watching one of his films. And if you do, you're not going to be that bothered about the quality of it anyway. So, you know, he's kind of found a happy medium in between where people know that he's bankable no matter what.
Maybe we should seek a unique angle to how AV Forums goes about reviewing films with Dwayne The Rock Johnson in, that as well as a standard score as applied to all films that we look at, there could be a Withers eroticism level, which will give dedicated fans of The Rock a real understanding of what they're putting themselves
in. The rocker erotic meter. Rocker,
yeah. Yeah. Maybe just different versions of Steve's little face, you know.
Or what about Steve Withers erotic reviews?
You better hope he doesn't listen to the podcast, guys.
What worries me is actually he'd be really up for it.
I don't know. Look how much. I mean, yeah, we could be on to the next 50 Shades of Grey here. 50 Shades of The Rock.
Yeah, good stuff. Anyway, if you're not a fan of The Rock and you want to go to the cinema this coming week, what can we go and see, Kaz?
Well, we've got if you're not up for action movies, then perfect antidote is Mamma Mia 2.
Oh hell no! I'll go and see The Rock again.
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to take a certain amount of persuasion to get me to see Mamma Mia 2, and I don't think that it can be born from anything that's on this planet. Alternatively, you can see Escape Plan 2. And I'd say for a lot of people, it might be a tough call. The early reviews are terrible, like straight to video level sequel. In fact, I think it was released in the States day and date, streaming, Blu-ray, and in the cinema. It's Sylvester Stallone's, you know, the team up with him and Arnie. The fabled, finally they get together on the screen. That was Escape Plan. It was enjoyable. It was pretty throwaway, but it was enjoyable. They've done a sequel. There's no Arnie. It's Dave Bautista instead, and apparently Sly's barely in it. And it's very much designed for Chinese markets, where it's already made back its money, and it's a low rent, low budget, straight to video style sequel that's probably aptly called Enter Hades, I think, in some territories. So I'd probably steer clear of that. I'm not quite sure I'm of the level where someone would have to make me choose between that and Mamma Mia 2, because I'd probably still go down too. But
between having pile surgery and watching Mamma Mia 2, I think I'd have my arse scraped.
Yeah, and unfortunately though, you just know it's going to make billions.
No, I don't begrudge people that enjoy things, just please do not ask me to enjoy it at the same. I admire the craftsmanship, the ability of Benny in particular in ABBA to create hook songs. It's just an innate ability to do that. Brilliant, well done. They are musically significant. I just can't get that excited about actually listening to it, and the idea of a film that just makes use of the songs can just go forth. My Withers eroticism level on that is very low. So yeah.
Well, does anybody know what the plot is? I mean, was there a plot to the first one?
I don't know.
I've never seen the first one, so I don't know if there's a plot.
I think there's some singing, and this one is more singing.
Okay.
Wow. I for one did not see that coming.
Good stuff. Right. So moving on from there, if we're not going to the cinema this week, what can we buy in Blu-ray and 4K Blu-ray?
Well, the biggest release is Tomb Raider, which is coming to Blu-ray and 4K. If you caught it at the cinema, I'm not sure you'll be itching to pick it up, but I'm sure it'll look spectacular in 4K. And we've also got Mum and Dad, which is a slightly strange Nicolas Cage movie. Yeah, I think it's one where they try and justify his kind of trademark overacting by making him a psychotic dad. So it's a movie where all the mums and dads in town go crazy, and the kids have to defend themselves from their murderous parents. They go completely crazy, and I'm not sure how much watchability that has, but at least it's got a reason for why Nicolas Cage is going crazy. There's an Arrow re-release of Bob Hoskins' excellent gangster movie, The Long Good Friday, which still stands the test of time.
Can I make a confession? Never seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it, let me guess.
Never seen it.
It's well worth watching. I mean, Hoskins is, I mean, he's tiny, but he's got some... He conveys
an air of menace.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he really does. That. It's a very gritty little...
It's got one of the greatest lines in any gangster film. The Mafia, I shit 'em.
Yeah.
And it's got an incredibly young Pierce Brosnan in it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's got everything. Thing. Got everything. Phil, get on it now. Okay. Its Withers eroticism level is a bit low, but otherwise it's a solid exercise.
Okay, I'll see if it's on a streaming service. You know, I've never ever seen Bullet, even though I'm a Mustang fan.
I've never seen Bullet.
I have now. I put that to rest at the weekend.
I watched it comparatively recently.
Yes.
Can you summarise the plot of Bullet?
Yeah, basically.
I love the fact that there's a pause. Even after literally, I can watch it.
Yeah.
And an hour afterwards, it's like, what's the plot?
You can't remember anything.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's a guy commits a robbery against the mafia, and he tries to disguise what he's doing and get the help of the police to get out of the country by disguising himself as somebody else who he's not. And they finally catch him as he's getting on the plane. Sorry for the spoilers, but it is a 50-year-old film. And it has one of the best car chases ever. And even now, having seen it relatively recently, I've got to say, it's still epic seeing these cars and the way that they use the cars. And for me, it's going to sound dead technical, but for me, it was an absolute masterclass in editing. How to edit.
The fact that they overtake the same Beetle.
Makes
32 upward gear changes and no downshifts, and the Dodge loses 17 hubcaps.
Yeah. But it's all about the technique. For me, that was like, I was more interested in how they edited that together at the time, because you got to go back 50 years. This was 50 years ago, and the techniques used and how they did it and how they did a lot of the in-car stuff. And obviously, McQueen did a lot of his own driving, but you know, it's not him because the mirror's facing up the way. The interior
Brad mirror. Eakins was
he can drive as well though, and the fact that again there was no CG, everything was done in camera, and the way it's edited, yes, there's umpteen cars the same in the backgrounds moving all the rest of it, but it was also done in open streets as well, so there's a lot of cars in there that didn't know what the hell was going on as they went past because not all the streets were closed down for it, so you've got that as well. It's really impressive. Even for a 50-year-old film, it is impressive how they did that. And like you say, the plot's a bit convoluted. And it's, to be honest, it's not a terribly great film. I didn't think it was really that good a film. But when you look at it and you think it was 50-year-old, yeah, it's impressive, really impressive. And McQueen is just ultra cool. I don't think the guy could be anything other than ultra cool.
No, he is. He's very cool. And his ethic towards doing his own stunts, it reminds me a bit of Cruise. I mean, back in the day, I guess that's what a lot of people did. But the rumor was that he not only did the driving, and they recorded the sound of his gear changes and used them in other movies because no one could change the gears quite like him. And but the crash sequence, He filmed it like 13 times and he couldn't crash the car. He was in such control of it, he couldn't crash the car, and they had to bring the stunt guy in to crash the car.
Yeah,
because it was called upon that his character should crash the car, and Steve McQueen, he's just not very good at crashing it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the original car, the interesting story is what happened to the cars after. So there was two cars used. There was one the stunt car, and the other car the A car, which was for all the other shots and so on. So the A car was sold by Warner Brothers. A couple of years after the film came out, and it was sold to a private individual, and it disappeared. Nobody knew where it was. It just disappeared off the face of the planet. The stunt car, it was supposed to have gone to a scrapyard to be crushed. It turned up 2 years ago, in a Mexican scrapyard, They've been able to verify that it is the real car. And then the A car turned up last year. It was in a private collection. The father died and handed it to the son. The son, realizing that it was the 50th anniversary, got in touch with Ford and said, look, I've got the original car. It hasn't been touched in any way, and it's at Goodwood Festival of Speed this weekend. It's the first time it's ever left the US. And it's really interesting, the story behind the car's fascinating. But it hasn't touched it in any way. It's still got the original tires on it. I mean, there's no tread on the thing, but it's still got the original tires on it. They haven't touched it in any way, and they reckon it's worth $4 million.
I wonder how much the Ford Puma that was in the advert with the CGI.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it was a terrible advert.
At the time, it was tremendously clever. It was clever, but it was like, yeah, this Fiesta in a dress is exactly reminiscent of the Bullet Mustang.
Although that Fiesta in a dress, remember, Ed, got 5-star reviews off.
It's a hilarious car to drive. The only problem is they rot. They rot like nobody's business.
Yeah, well, most
because it comes from the same vintage as the original Audi TT, where it's like, oh, we've made a concept car. There's really positive feedback. Let's productionize it. And the thing when you do that, things that designers do that look hella cool under spotlight on a stand at a motor show don't really work in real life. So anyone that ever owned or used a Ford Puma will know this. If you open the boot and it's raining, the way that the water pools on the roof, it then immediately just goes straight into the boot. Immediately. If you see people still using Ford Pumas, you'll notice on a rainy day they don't generally open the boot if they have any desire for the car not to rot from the inside out. They'll just stick things behind the front seat. And obviously with the Audi TT, they launched it and then immediately had to recall them all because they had lift-off oversteer that meant that if you did lift off in the middle of a bend, you died. Yeah. So they had to completely revise it to deal with that. But so it's from a brave and noble time. But it's one of the little cars that cemented got Ford out of the reputation for just being dismal and actually making things that were entertaining.
I had three Pumas. I absolutely loved them. They're some of the funnest cars to drive, and the last one I had was a racing Puma.
Ooh,
and if they still made them, I would own one. It was a lot of fun, and
I have to ask,
nippy.
What did you sell your racing Puma for?
Oh God, next to nothing. Because
have you seen how much they go for now?
Yeah, I'm sure because.
Don't tell me.
Yeah, you know, you have a wife, you have a kid, you're not driving around in a racing Puma. It just wasn't a practical car to keep and maintain.
No.
And it was sucking money. So
not as much as it did for Ford. Ford lost money on every single one they sold.
I know. I mean, it was. I wish it had worked out differently for them because I did love the car.
Well, no. They made a conscious decision that it was going to be a halo product, but essentially it was one of those ones where it's like, oh, we'd like you to do this. It's like, are you sure? So every single racing Puma has a seam welded chassis, which is properly expensive to do and had to be done by SVO. And I think Ford lost $5,000 or $6,000 on every single one that left the showroom.
That was the racing one.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're phenomenally nice cars. Very, very, very growly. And because it's a light car, I mean, very nippy. You would surprise people off the lights because I don't think they expected it out of what looked a little bit like a shiny, slightly lower Puma. And yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, it's sad seeing the way things are going, and it's one of the reasons why I went out and basically it was heart overhead buying the Mustang, because everything else is a box on wheels and looks the same as everything else at the minute. It's when it comes to cars now, can you tell your Hyundais from your Volkswagens, from your Audis, from your Seats, from, you know, everything just looks the same nowadays, and it's really, really annoying the way things have gone, because it used to be the case of that now and again you had a manufacturer like Ford who'd come along with the Puma or with the Focus. Do you remember the original Focus when it was launched? It was so removed from everything else that was on the road at the time. It was a real game changer at the time, and everybody lapped it up. They wanted one because it was so different. And it's just sad looking at the way cars are now, Ed. And, you know, we're talking about barn finds, and we're talking about, you know, old cars getting found in scrapyards and stuff that are worth a mint. I don't see anybody being really excited with it in 25 years or 50 years time, or a barn find for a Kia.
Well, this is possibly the case, but I do think car manufacturers are trying. I mean, I think personally, I think the absolute point of people not giving any shits at all in terms of design and excitement was the mid-90s, where everything was a sort of jelly blob shape, and it all, you know, if you took the grills and badges off them and viewed them from side profiles, there was an actual piece in car magazine. It's like, oh look, it's one of those, and it was, you know, they were 40 cars with the identifying grill and badge removed, and actually telling them apart was virtually impossible. There are some hideous cars on the road today, but generally speaking, they're all relatively distinctive. And I've just found a nice racing Puma for sale that Kaz can compare the price of that.
£14,000.
Knew
it wouldn't have been as much as that.
Yes, it was. It's 17K, 17 or 18K.
The trouble is, in order to get it into the condition that you can sell it for 14 grand, you probably spend 8 or 9 grand.
That one's out of that condition, in fairness. From the description, it's been dry stored its entire life and looked after by anal retentives. But nonetheless, it is a £14,000 Ford Puma.
Here we go.
Actually, there's one here on 34,000 miles since 2000, and this car looks like new. But the price of a Ford Racing Puma that looks like new is £22,750.
There you go, Kaz. You should have hung on to it. You should have shoved it in a garage or in a barn somewhere. And
I get the bus.
Is it a Ford Racing bus, though?
Yeah, is it the racing bus?
Well, the thing I like about the number 16 is, you know, it pulls away from the lights. It's got real traction. You know, it goes away. Oh, it's beautiful, beautiful ride. You know, as it hits the potholes and your head hits the ceiling. Oh, yeah.
So it's a bit firm on the suspension then.
Yeah, it is. You know,
is it lowered?
But you get a if an old person's getting on it, yes, it does get lowered.
Has she got Wi-Fi?
Oh yeah, exactly. I can charge anything I want now. You know, I just take anything that's got a USB port on it now. On, you know, I'll get my money's worth.
There you go. And on that transport bombshell, for some how we've run out of time on the podcast this week. My thanks to Ed Selly.
I've lost the bleeps. I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
Kaz Harlow.
Now you will see that evil will always triumph because good is done.
And Mark Buttright.
You went over my helmet.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and videos. And of course, why not leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, but only if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you again next week.